I find myself this morning wanting to apologize to you because I feel that this is kind of tedious.
Well, it is to me. It is to me.
Because I'm still not getting, I'm not getting down to what I want to. But maybe today I can, I want to stimulate some sparks here. And not Doug sparks, but just general sparks. On this subject, I tried to find, as I said, some books on this. Maybe somebody has covered this whole subject and written it out somewhere, and I could have saved myself all this time. But on the other hand, it probably wouldn't have spoken to me. But I'm trying to set a background for spiritual leadership. That's what we're trying to get to. And decision-making as it relates to the navigators. And as I find myself spending my evenings, and that's why I haven't shown up here, because I didn't get a chance to put things in order like I wanted before I arrived. I find myself saying, man, we should have started in the last one first. But at any rate, let me see if today we can't conclude the aspect on general subject of authority, so that we'll go into spiritual leadership tomorrow as it relates to authority. And then my last session, which I think is on Friday, I'm going to take up, it's a little bit different, but decision-making from the book of Acts, as I see it, and as it applies to the decision-making process and the navigators and various kinds of decisions and who ought to make them and how. And we'll see if we can get a little insight on that subject, because I found that one of the great criticisms that we get in here and there is not just the decision that's made, but how it's made, the process. And right now we are in the midst of trying to determine, and constantly trying to determine, who makes what decisions and by what process. But today, let me just review a little bit. First of all, the fact that a preoccupation with the subject of authority can be dangerous. If we zero in on just the importance of authority itself, and as we mentioned, Luke 10:20, when we begin, in this rejoice not that the spirits are subject unto you, that you have authority there, but rejoice because your names are written in heaven. Have your perspective clear. I was talking with someone earlier, just before breakfast, and reminded me that many people feel that a leader is someone who tells you what to do. And that is a mistaken notion of leadership. Authority and leadership are not synonymous. That's why I'm eager to get to that point. They are not synonymous. Being the boss is telling other people what to do. And to me, there are heavy vestiges of the basic sin of mankind of self-centeredness and self-assertiveness that are residual in that attitude. That a leadership is somebody who tells other people what to do, and I can hardly wait to get to be a leader so I can tell other people what to do. And that's bad news, not good news. Also, there's a mistaken notion that leadership and position are synonymous, and that is not true. Leadership and position are not synonymous. Leadership and authority are not synonymous. Leadership has to do with influence. I once read that at any given meeting, the man with the plan leads the meeting regardless of who the chairman is. If you just see three or four people standing around and they're talking on a certain subject, and in that group is one person who has thought it through before it's through, inevitably that person just informally is in charge of that meeting. They're the leader regardless of who has the position or the title. So these are some kinds of things that I want to get to, and I'm laying a foundation for. Now, he said also that in an ordered universe, there must be authority and submission to authority. And God set that up. And we simply pointed out that in the relationships having to do with mankind, that you could point out these relationships. Now, well, that's fine. That's just precisely where I wanted it. Well, that happens to be where I wanted it anyway. Thanks. Because as we get down to it, we have a spiritual movement, number 7. We also have an organization called the Navigators. The question comes, are we a movement or an organization? A lot of people feel that they, the non-staff laborers, exist to serve the organization, where the intent is that our organization is in existence to serve the movement, if I could use these terms. But, see, we could have an informal movement, but we don't know how to perpetuate it and to export it, at least I don't, without having some people full-time in it. And the moment you do that, you have an organization. And the moment you have an organization, then it comes under some of the laws of the land, and it begins to get complicated. And the first thing you know, 7 serves 6, and 6 is serving 5, instead of the other way around. Now, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. The organization is made for the spiritual movement, not the spiritual movement for the organization. And this tension of this evidence to try to keep it in priority is the thing that we struggle with. Then we come along and find certain governmental regulations that impinge themselves upon how we do business. And the next thing you know, our policies are getting set here, or set here from the management books, instead of starting here. But it is not simple. Then it comes along the fact that we're parents, and it has that relationship. For instance, the board of directors of the Navigators has no business telling me about certain things relative to my wife and family. Right? And therefore, I would quit. If there were certain things that they required, it would be beyond their limits. So all authorities have limits in how to relate these. Therefore, I say, as we concluded, that ultimately the choice comes down to the individual. And you can't get away from that. But I find that leaders, whether they're political or whether they are industrial, are afraid of that concept, but it's a fact. That the ultimate person who makes the choices of which authority and which situation relates in a given circumstance is the individual who, according to the Bible, will have to give account of himself to God. But choices is very important. And see, these are now I begin to get into a little, we're getting arguments over this subject. That's why I said to one of my friends, I said, what's the president of your company? He said, he's just a bunker. I said, he thinks he actually makes the decisions that really run that country, that company, doesn't he? But there are thousands of decisions made by people down the line that determine the success or failure of that company. I remember one businessman, I said, do you ever get involved, a Christian man, head of his company, in the family affairs of your employees? He said, no, I would never touch that. I said, do you realize that if a man's not getting along with his wife, and they have a fight in the morning, and he slams the door and goes off to work in a huff, you're losing money on him all day long. Just from a pure economic point of view. And so that you can't really divorce things. And so therefore, I would say that a spiritual man who is an employer also could and should be a spiritual leader and have a redemptive approach to leadership in his automobile agency. But we don't want that. Now, self-centeredness came along and brought disorder to these relationships. Now, all authorities are limited. And our authority over people is limited. And we tend to try to be God. That's a basic sin. So it comes along to the community ministry. And maybe we can get away with this in the collegiate ministry where we have them check in on what to do on weekends and have a pretty tightly structured affair. But a man gets married, he has a job, he has a church, and if he can't commit to us 5 nights a week plus his weekends, then we say he's not committed. And in my opinion, we could very well be exceeding the limits of our authority as relates to that person and we should not write him off as not being committed. That we have to learn how to help and to use and to work with somebody who can only give us one night a week, or two nights a week, or as my brother who has a harvest season to take care of, has a family to relate to. And there is a tendency in us, and it's in all of us in varying degrees, to be God. Because that's the central sin of the universe. When it comes to the marriage situation, do we counsel or do we give the instruction? We make the decision. I like the way John Ridgway put it recently at a staff conference down in Australia. He said, God has no grandchildren. I never heard it put like that before, but that's true. God has no grandchildren. We are all directly his children. And we use the illustration of the wheel, and it's so easy for us to have hubless wheels. Jesus Christ is to be Lord of that life, not me or you as a spiritual leader. I am an under-shepherd. I am a helper of their faith. But I'm just trying to say that this thing of self-centeredness, which is sin, so has affected us that it affects even well-meaning spiritual leadership. And Peter had to make the statement, neither as being lords over God's heritage. Because there is a natural tendency among human beings to lord over whether it's the family, the wife, the kids. I remember one fellow who wanted to go to the mission field. This is years ago. He married a girl who was happened to be helping in Trotman Home. And we found out when he got married that he thought this little wife of his was sort of his servant. And if he said jump, she only had one response would be, or one question would simply be, how high? And Doss didn't think that was a very good basis on which to establish a marriage, to say nothing about go to the mission field. So he suggested that they get that thing straightened out before they go overseas. And he was precisely right. There are limits. And, but there's something about us. Okay. All authorities are limited. Now, therefore, the need, we said, is redemptive, reconciling, restorative relationships. And that is done by influence, not by force. Now, we can and have to, in society, government, do external forming and forcing because they're on the external controls because of the lack of internal controls. But in a spiritual ministry, it seems to me, that what we're trying to do is develop the internal controls that diminish the need for the external. And the first step, because of sin, because of the disorder, is surrender and submission. Surrender and submission. So we talked about that. Now let me see. What did we say we do about this? Oh. I'm doing it. What do you know? One time one of my kids says, Dad, you know, I think you have a green thumb. In fact, I think you have five green thumbs and more hands. I'm not necessarily noted for being mechanical. For writing either, I can see that too. But, so we talked about the first step being surrender, submission. Submit yourself therefore to God. Be subject. Can't read it. Obey and honor, be subject, and et cetera. Read it better here. Be submissive, obey, submit, and be subject. Now I don't want to do it, I can't read it. Now today then we come to the exercise of authority. We talked about the definition of authority, the authority in general, these various relationships, then or the problem of authority rather, self-centeredness, and then we talked about submission to authority or response to authority, which is submission. Now today the subject is the exercise of authority. And as before, I have some propositions to make, to state. And as I say, next time around, I'll put the propositions on overhead, but I'm not satisfied with the way they're stated yet. But I'd like to begin with this point, that we have to put two more words with this. When you have the word authority, we've got to add the word now responsibility and accountability.
So we'll have those three words. We'll run through what we have to say this morning. Responsibility, which is an obligation to perform, and accountability. And I lost my definition on that. I left it home, in other words. So I'll have to get Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, 7th edition, and find out what that is. But let me just pause here on authority. That authority is not a bad word. It's not a naughty word. It's a good word. It's a legitimate thing. We have to remind ourselves of this now. And we live in a day of rebellion against authority because that's innate, that's built in. No wonder the children would rebel. We shouldn't be surprised of that sweet, cute little thing. That's just part of the nature. And authority is a legitimate thing. And the interesting thing is that authority is given as a reward. Actually, more authority is a reward. So it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. Now in Luke 22, verses 24 to 28, we have the case of the Last Supper, where the apostles are arguing about which of them is the greatest. And Jesus rebukes them and gives them some instruction. And then he says in Luke 22:28-30, "You are those who have continued with me in my trial. As my Father appointed a kingdom for me, so do I appoint for you, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." He quieted them down. Says, don't fuss among yourselves about who's the greatest and all the rest. But he said, the time will come when you will sit on thrones, judging, deciding, which is authority, the right to decide. So he's not saying that authority itself is bad. As a result, you've been with me in my trials, you will have authority. Luke 19, we have the parable of the pounds, verses 11 to 27. He tells about a nobleman went to a far country to receive kingly power and return. He called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 pounds and said to them, trade with these till I come. This is now Luke 19:13. But his citizens hated him and sent an embassy, so on, we do not want this man to reign over us. Verse 16, the first came before him, saying, Lord, your pound has made 10 pounds more. And he said to him, well done, good servant, because you have been faithful in a very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. The reward for good work, for faithfulness, will be authority. And it goes right on down there. Now, I wondered, why would he give authority as a reward? Could you figure that out? Why would you think authority would be a reward? You get more authority. The successful, faithful discharge of authority results in more. Yes. Okay, what's that reference on that? 2 Samuel 5:12. Anybody else have a thought on why authority, the reward for faithfulness and the discharge of it, would result in more? Part of the nature of God.
That's along the line of a theory I came up with, that God is interested in character. That character is determined by choices. Authority is the right to choose. Right choices mean right character. And right character is rewarded by the opportunity for more choices, and thus further character development. Jim?
Another reason is that the fruit of success is people that have to use for guidance.
Hmm?
And so they give it to each other.
Now, this is what I need, is help on this outline. I appreciate it. Okay, yes, Gert?
It's harder to relate to your followers than to your leaders. So people who can relate to followers can have more followers because they're better servants. All these conceptual things.
All right, good. Some of these thoughts are going to be excellent. They're going to come back in again a little later as we talk about spiritual leadership. Now, this matter of choices, character being determined by choices and authority is the right to choose, that's also true of submission. That's a matter of choices. And that results in character, according to James 1, 2 to 4. See, rejoice in your troubles, count it all joy, knowing that certain things will happen, and end result of right responses to that kind of thing is stable Christian character. And God is interested in character. And earlier I said that these relationships that we talked about come down to choices that the individual makes. And those choices have to do with character. And furthermore, I think it also has to do with the fact that God is interested in a personal relationship with us on a day-by-day, situation-by-situation thing, rather than giving us a detailed book in which we look under A16 and find out what the procedural manual says on how we ought to do on a given situation. Instead, I pray and I'm prompted by the Holy Spirit as how to react in a given situation, what choice to make. That's in Galatians 5, etc. And that, therefore, I learn to walk with Him moment by moment by the prompting of the Holy Spirit, Romans 8 and Galatians 5. So that makes it a personal thing and not a mechanical thing. All right, now my second proposition. The first one, that authority is a good word. It's a reward. The second proposition is that he who has authority must accept responsibility. Now, a lot of people would like the authority, but not the responsibility. But you can't have both ways. Now, responsibility is the obligation to perform. And authority, if you have it, you must function. Now, in the parable of the pounds we mentioned, the fellow with 1 pound didn't function. He didn't do anything with it, and he got in some deep trouble. He did not function. You must function. You take the case of a husband and a father. He must function. 1 Timothy 3, 4, and 5, speaking of an elder, he must manage his household well, else he's disqualified for spiritual leadership. The case of Eli. Eli knew that his sons were sinning, and he did not stop them, God said. He did not function. I know sometimes with some parents, and I was tempted in my own family at times, when I had a real difficulty with a teenager coming up, to wonder, could I send him off to school somewhere, send him off to somebody else to help? And I'm only speaking in general terms. I'm not talking about specifics. I'm not saying there aren't exceptions to the rule. But for me, at least, as a result of struggle and getting down on my knees in prayer, I made up my mind that for God, for me, that we were going to fight the battle at home. We were not going to escape the responsibility. We are not going to send it away. We're going to win or lose it right there. And as a husband and a father, there is no way you've got to function, accept that responsibility. And if it meant quit travel, quit the job, whatever it took, we're going to stay there, and we're going to win the battle in our home, and we're going to fight it right there, on our knees, and with love. So we're not going to try to send the problems away, or escape them, or get away from them ourselves, but we're going to fight the battle right there. You've got to function. God gave you the the right to decide, to act, to direct, to restrain, to take action, and you've got to stick with it. And there's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You're a governor, you got to govern. Saul didn't function. He disobeyed God and he got removed. Spiritual leaders must function. Titus 2:15. Paul said to Titus, "Declare these things, exhort and reprove with all authority. Let no one disregard you." Now get a hold of things, Titus, and function. And so you've got the servant king, you've got the submissive leadership, there's the combination, there's the both of them. You must function. He who has authority must accept responsibility. He must function, and he must function though challenged and even rejected. And the story of how Jesus' authority was challenged and how he handled it is just it's a couple messages in itself. I was amazed at how much there's there. The Apostle Paul, as you know, had his authority challenged. But he functioned. He who has authority must accept responsibility. He has an obligation to perform. He must function. Third proposition. That responsibility must be discharged with the proper attitude and action. In other words, we're back to the fact, just as there is redemptive submission, there must be redemptive leadership. The redemptive exercise of authority. The responsibility must be discharged with the proper attitude and actions, or in other words, redemptively. The redemptive exercise of authority. And that has to do with the manner in which it's done, the attitude by which it's done. Just as in decision making, we'll find out that unless a moral issue is involved, I believe that the process of making the decision is more important than the product of the decision. Because if the right process with a group of people is followed, they'll make a poor decision work. Whereas an excellent decision made with the wrong process, where the people are not with him, will not work. So the attitude, the process, is vital in the exercise of authority, and we have some scripture precedents for that. I'm ahead of the game. I didn't make one for this. I'll have to read it to you. God, for instance, acted redemptively. God, all authority comes from him. He sent Jesus to be the propitiation for our sins. He so loved the world. Husbands, love. He is the head. He's not trying to be the head. He is the head. And he's to love his wife. Colossians says, be not harsh with them. Exercise your authority, your responsibility as the head, with love and without harshness. Parents, to fathers, don't provoke your children. Don't provoke. Love. He is the head. He's not trying to be the head. He is the head. And he's to love his wife. Colossians says, be not harsh with them. Exercise your authority, your responsibility as the head, with love and without harshness. Parents, to fathers, don't provoke your children. Don't provoke them. And of course, you know, as always, the Holy Spirit prompts the writers to go right to the very heart of the need. And what do we fathers need as much as any about our children? Is not to provoke them, to aggravate them to anger. Maybe not you, but it's been for me. Governors, rule justly. 2 Samuel 23:3. Employers, forbear threatening. Forbear threatening. Ephesians 6:9. Spiritual leaders, not as lords over God's heritage. 1 Peter 5:3.
redemptive
exercise of authority.
Now, somehow or other, it seems to me that there's where the spiritual dimension has to come in to restore these relationships properly. You want to just flip that off just for a little bit till I get through this illustration. Be discharged with proper attitudes and actions, or redemptively. Now, I know you know that, but I'm seeing God work in my own family, and there's some other instances I could give also. But some of my greatest experiences there are just as a head of my own household. Flip it back on, thanks. I didn't want to have that particular story just told out beyond this group. Well, then my next proposition would be that not only does authority bring responsibility, and that responsibility must be discharged redemptively, restoratively, in a reconciling way, but responsibility brings accountability. Accountability. And as an illustration there, we have Luke 12, 41 to 48, of these four stewards that Jesus talked about. Incidentally, the book of Luke, to my amazement, is loaded with information on the subject of authority. It's probably Luke and 1 Peter, chapter 2 and 5, have, if you want to localize it on authority, that's where you find it. But here, Jesus told the story in answer to a question that Peter said about Luke 12:42. Who then is the faithful and wise steward whom his master will set over his household to give them their portion of food at the proper time? And then he tells about four different stewards. Four servants. Now, the job description was what? What were they to do? Feed the household. It was a delegated responsibility to feed the household. Then the master comes home and he checks up, sees how things are going. Well, the first steward was a faithful one. And he did what he was told to do, and he was rewarded by being set over all his possessions. Here again, faithful discharge of responsibility, more responsibility. But the second one began to beat the men servants and the maid servants and to get drunk, and he said, I'm not going to be checked up on. The master's not coming home for a long time. And it says that he'll be cut in pieces, the tyrannical servant. Pretty rough treatment. He gave rough treatment, he'll get rough treatment. The measure you give will be the measure you get. Well, the third servant, verse 47, he knew his master's will but did not make ready or act according to his will, shall receive a severe beating. So the negligent servant, he knew better, he got a severe beating. He was called to account and got a beating. The fourth, he did not know, but he did what deserved a beating, and he received a light beating. The ignorant got a light beating. So there was the faithful, the tyrannical, the negligent, and the ignorant servant. Then the conclusion of the application, verse 48b. Everyone to whom much is given, of him will much be required, and of him to whom men commit much, they will demand the more. Everyone to whom much is given, of him will much be what? Required. And of him to whom men commit much, they will demand the more. There is an accountability. And incidentally, one's knowledge is taken into consideration in that accountability. And there's a whole other subject. That knowledge in itself oftentimes constitutes a responsibility to act. He that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin, James 4:17. As you can see, as we've been going along, there are all kinds of interesting bypaths we could get off to. I'm trying to stay in the main stream of it. So responsibility brings accountability. Now, here's where I run into a little trouble.
Maybe I'm stretching a point. Maybe I'm not. You can help me. Accountability is to the source of one's responsibility and authority. You're accountable to those from whom you got your responsibility and your authority. And so therefore, there is an intermediate accountability to men and an ultimate accountability to God. Let's talk about the intermediate responsibility to men. Everyone to whom much is given, of him will much be required, and of him to men commit much, they will demand the more. Responsibility and authority conferred by men means that they will turn around and demand or require an accounting. Now, what I want to suggest is that that accounting is both from the top down and the bottom up. Now, let's say that here's, let me pick out Jim Peterson. Now, Jim Peterson is a divisional director. He reports to me. Now, I have some authority relative to Jim Peterson, right? I hope that's right. Jim says it's right. Where did I get that authority? Well, someone says you got it from God. Okay. From, someone says the board of directors. I somehow or other, don't tell the board, some of these guys are on the board of directors. I don't know. I don't feel all that accountable to the board for some reason or other. Because the board really didn't, what? I missed that. Yes. Because the board didn't give me authority over Jim Peterson. Now, I do feel an accountability, but not the greatest accountability, because it seems to me that the authority I got primarily relative to Jim Peterson was given me by Jim Peterson. That he gave up some of his sovereignty, which is in the very nature of man that God gave him, gave it up and said to me, Lorne, you be my leader, I'll respond to you, and I accepted that. Therefore, I got authority from Jim Peterson, from the bottom up, if you want to put it that way. I also got some authority from the top down, from the board. But in the case of Jim Peterson, then, I am also accountable to Jim Peterson. If I am accountable to the source of my authority and responsibility, then it makes me responsible down, accountable down in the organization as well as up. I am accountable both ways. Now, this is the point that I told you I made with some businessmen in corporate life, and they were Christians, and they said, well, what you say makes sense. But this one fellow says, everything within me revolts against the idea. That somehow or other that all power resides in the board of directors, then some of that's parceled down to the president, and he in turn parcels some of this down to the divisional directors, who give some authority down to the regional directors, who give some authority down. And I say, whoops, hold it. I think that's Whistling Dixie. I think that ignores the fact that the residual authority given by God is to every one of you. God has no grandchildren. And in a working relationship, we surrender a certain amount of personal sovereignty to someone else and to the group for the sake of group accomplishment towards an objective. And therefore, the leader is responsible up and he's responsible down. He's accountable up and he's accountable down, and that makes him a servant both ways, up and down, just like Jesus said. Now, we've got a staff of 1,300 full-time people, and this may be wrong, but I have to say, in my heart, I feel my greatest accountability to that staff. And a lot of times when I felt like resigning, it'd be very easy for me to turn in a resignation to the board of directors, but very, very hard for me to turn in a resignation to the Navigator staff. And I'm more, and I just can't walk out. And if I have a part in people being in various parts of the world, and I know that sometime I will need to step aside. And it's God put them there. But the fact still remains that I think when it comes right down to it, I can't walk out on my friends. And my accountability, I feel very strongly downward, even more than upward. So, we're a servant. If I ever write a book on this subject, it will say you live in the middle of the intersection, the traffic goes both ways. You're a servant up, you're a servant down, and you're a servant sideways. And that's precisely what Jesus said. And then I begin to ask myself, as I sit working on this, what kind of a servant am I? And then I say, who's sufficient for these things? And I have to come back to 1 Corinthians 3:5, our sufficiencies of God. I serve inadequately, but still I'm a servant. Well, as I say, you'll get some trouble in management books on that concept. But there it is. Now then, I'm just about finished here. So there's an intermediate accountability, I say, to the source of one's responsibility and authority. And that can be up and down. Now we'll talk later, if we get a little chance, about the establishing of the relationship that Jim Peterson and I have. When he submitted some of sovereignty to me, I also voluntarily accepted a responsibility. We both did toward each other. So he has an accountability to me also, but he also has an accountability to those who work with him. So again, we're all servants every which way you look. Now, our ultimate accountability, however, is to God. And this is what makes all the difference in this whole business. Romans 14:12, so then every one of us shall give account of himself to God. Now, I'd like to point out that to me, that this is what puts a whole new perspective on the entire subject of authority and submission. This point is so big, so important, that it gets to the heart of the whole world's mess. Husbands, First Peter 3:7, you better treat your wife right, that your prayers be not hindered. Wives, submit yourselves as to the Lord. Parents, bring your children up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Eli, you should have brought them up to know the Lord. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. Governors, govern in the fear of God. There is an ultimate accountability of every relationship. Governed, if you resist God. Employers, don't forget you also have a master in heaven. You also have a master in heaven. Employees, submit as to Christ. Spiritual leaders, you lead in the Lord. And I couldn't find one for followers that specifically says that. And maybe you might find one. But look, it's an accountability to God, to the Lord, the fear of God. You resist God, you have a master in heaven, as to Christ in the Lord. And what is the problem in the world today? That God has been set aside. But when all of it's in the light of God, in our ultimate accountability to Him, it makes a whole new perspective, doesn't it? This discharge of responsibility. Whether you're a parent, husband, wife, governor, governed, employer, employee, whatever. I didn't put down the references because you can find them. But just, the reason I put this here is just to see how it follows down through. It all takes God into consideration. And we started by this whole subject of authority by saying that all authority comes from God. Therefore, all ultimate accountability goes back to God. And every one of us shall give account of himself to God. Now that's a fantastic thought. There will be a writing of all accounts. God will judge the world in righteousness. The story has not all been told. The last chapter has not been written. Now let me read a quote from Solzhenitsyn in his book, The Gulag Archipelago, which I have not read, but Ed Rice has read, and copied out this quote for me. Power is a poison well known for thousands of years. If only no one were ever to acquire material power over others. But to the human who has faith in some force that holds dominion over all of us and is therefore conscious of his own limitations, power is not necessarily fatal. Oh, it's quite a sentence. But to the human who has faith in some force that holds dominion over all of us and who is therefore conscious of his own limitations, power is not necessarily fatal. That's what we've been talking about. For those, however, who are unaware of any higher sphere, it is a deadly poison. For them, there is no antidote. I thought that's quite insightful along the lines of our study. So our job is to get God into the picture. And so now we're ready to talk about spiritual leadership. Influencing people towards God. As priests representing the people to God, as prophets representing God to people, spiritual leadership, that comes up tomorrow. We have 4 minutes, I think. Any questions?